From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The White House counsel to President Nixon in the Watergate era is on Capitol Hill today. John Dean was a star witness during the Watergate proceedings. His testimony in the 1970s focused on obstruction of justice. It helped bring down a president. Now he's back to give his opinion on President Trump's actions in response to the Mueller investigation. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is here. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And let's remind people, John Dean, a household name decades ago, but familiar now if you watch CNN, for instance. He's a big critic of the president. Here he is speaking to CNN's Jake Tapper in April about Mueller's decision not to exonerate President Trump on obstruction of justice.
This is clear obstruction, Jake. If you endeavor to obstruct, and there is much evidence here of endeavor, you violated the obstruction statute.
But Ron, still, why are Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee calling Dean in now?
You called Dean a star witness a moment ago, just as we all did back in the Watergate era. And right now, the Democrats need a star witness in their pursuit of President Trump. They'd like it to be Robert Mueller, of course, but he's not very excited about the role. And they'd like it to be Don McGahn, the former White House counsel. McGahn had that job under Trump that John Dean had under Richard Nixon, exact same job. So plan B here is, until they can find a court to enforce their subpoenas on some of these present day figures, bringing in Dean will highlight the issue of obstruction, like you said, and it will link the behavior of the two presidents in no uncertain terms. And others on the witness list today may do much the same or similar things. But Dean will bring the cameras.
Well, it's funny you said witless list, because that's what some of the critics of it might be saying. The president called Dean a sleazebag in a tweet yesterday. White House advisor Kellyanne Conway had this to say on Fox News this morning.
I passed four state bars, never been disbarred, yeah. Never went to jail for obstruction of justice, and don't plan on it. But they're picking their lawyers from TV now. Remember, right. He also tried all to right. derail Brett Kavanaugh's nomination.
We remember.
This is not a credible person.
And Kellyanne Conway referring there to John Dean's criminal record, because he was a part of the cover-up before he became a witness against it. He actually served time for that period of time where he was, as I said, a part of the cover-up. And this testimony we just heard, the Fox morning host there completely agreeing with Kellyanne Conway, his testimony isn't likely to sway any Republicans.
No, it's not going to sway any Republicans, nor is it expected to. John Dean went to jail and served 4 months of a 1 to 4 year sentence back in the mid-1970s. He was also disbarred for his part in a criminal conspiracy in the White House. And it's important to remember, that's what he was punished for, his own part in a criminal conspiracy in the White House, which he bailed out on and exposed. So in that sense, he was discredited as a lawyer. But it's worth noting that he was discredited for actions taken at the direction of the White House team working for President Nixon, and that when John Dean said, look, I think I might need my own lawyer for what we're doing here, Nixon himself tried to keep him in line.
I want to ask you about something upcoming. The House of Representatives will vote to approve a civil contempt resolution tomorrow. This would be against Attorney General Bill Barr and former White House counsel Don McGahn. This isn't the same thing as voting to hold the two in contempt of Congress. That's something Democrats have threatened. But what is this civil contempt resolution and why now?
It isn't quite the same thing, and it processes differently in the court system. The Democrats here are trying to get these people to testify, to get them before the committee, before the cameras, so the country can see them talk about all of these issues under oath. They're not trying to send them to jail. They're not trying to harass them. They're trying to get their testimony. And it's happening just right now because this is the Democrats' alternative or plan B again sort of strategy for pursuing the president, but not actually starting a formal impeachment proceeding.
Yeah, and we're seeing today, in the minute we have, that the Justice Department will give documents related to the Mueller investigation to the House Judiciary Committee. Democrats in the DOJ have disagreed about this, but could this concession have an impact on that contempt vote?
Surely. And the idea, of course, would be to obviate the vote entirely, to say, hey, look, see, we're cooperating. We're doing everything we can. And At the same time, I don't think the two sides are really there yet, and we do expect the vote to go ahead tomorrow, at least at this point. But it does show that negotiations are going on, and the negotiations are still possible. And there are those people in the House leadership who would very much like to get the goods, get a full look at the Mueller report unredacted, see the underlying documents and evidence without actually having to go to a contempt of Congress or a formal impeachment proceeding.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Now, let's turn to horse racing. Two more horses died at the Santa Anita racetrack over the weekend. That brings the total to 29 at that track in the last 6 months. The California Horse Racing Board says racing should be suspended for the rest of the current season. That ends June 23rd. But Santa Anita's management is resisting. Can they do that? Yes. Several of the horses that died this year were euthanized after suffering catastrophic injuries on top of old injuries. The deaths put horse racing under a spotlight during the Triple Crown season, which ended with Sir Winston's victory in the Belmont Saturday. Let's bring in Joe Drape. Joe, there have been many more than 29 horses who've died across the country. You cover horse racing for the New York Times. The racing seems insignificant at this point. Who won what? Would you agree?
It's very insignificant, Robin. Yeah. In fact, this Triple Crown season should just be thrown out. And it's unfair to the owners and horses and trainers of the ones that won. But what's dominating any talk of horse racing are these dead horses out in Santa Anita. And they've been commanding the spotlight now since December 26. And it's really got the sport to the tipping point. People are talking about should horse racing even exist. And they have a right to.
Well, and there are people doing more than talking about it. They're trying to get it, I think, as a referendum in California. And as you remind us, nearly 10 horses a week on average died at American racetracks in 2018. So while it's horrendous at Santa Anita, 10 horses a week on average across the country. So talk a little bit about, first, why there's a horse racing board in California and they can't just tell Santa Anita to shut down.
Well, that's part of the inherent problem of horse racing. It's a patchwork deal. The regulators in California is the California Horse Racing Board. But in all government, there's a bureaucracy. Now, they can shut them down after 10 days with the public notice. That's according to the regulations. But, you know, that will get them a little bit past their due date or how much they go. Mm. You know, this is a really bold move by not only the Stronach Group who owns Santa Anita, but the owners and horsemen and trainers out there. They are arguing two things, that there's a practical reason. We've got to have some place for these horses to train, about 1,800 of them out there. The other reason is sort of the aspirational. Believe it or not, since they put some very meaningful reforms out there on drugs, basically the safety and welfare of horses, the rates have come down. But, you know, once you get to 20-something, cut it by 50%, that's just still too many.
You mentioned the Stronach Group. They own Santa Anita. They did announce a ban in March on the use of whips and medication on racing day. But talk about the divide in sports. You write, on one side, horse breeders, owners who back a federal bill to create a uniform national standard for drug testing and medication rules. It could be overseen by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. On the other, horse trainers, racetrack owners who find this too expensive and intrusive.
Yeah, and it's a lot like society, the 1% versus everybody else. It's a $15 billion business. The breeders, mainly Kentucky-based, and owners, they know that the sport is in peril right now, and they want it cleaned up quickly. They want less racing. They want more oversight. But, you know, people own tracks, hundreds of them out there. States regulate them. There's a lot of tax money in there. They want those streams to continue. The guys who own and train horses, the little guys, that's how they make their living. They need a place to race. So, you know, you got a big divide between the rich and the poor. The drug thing is the little guys say, hey, this is how we keep our horses healthy, and this is how we afford to keep showing up for the races, to keep the revenue stream going and the track in business. So, you know, there's a very fundamental difference here that needs to be overcome.
And just to be clear here, again, we talked about banning whips on race days and banning certain medications, and you just saying that some owners are saying, hey, these medications are what's keeping the revenue stream going. Do you ever see a time, Joe, when horse racing might be just stripped of all the medications, all the whips, maybe just some, you know, mild medications to help a horse overcome a small injury. And it just gets complete. You do see that.
Yes, and it could happen. This is the frustrating thing for people. It could happen next week. It's that easy to do. People have been talking about this for 50 years. In Europe and the rest of the world, they have these rules. All they're asking is, say, American horsemen to do is to match the standards overseas. And overseas, their death rate is 2.5 to 5 times less than ours. Mm. So this can be fixed. And I think anybody who's been around it a long time kind of wants to pull their hair out right now, because this is something that can be done quickly and effectively. And once more, and I say once more because I have congressional testimony on these issues from 1980. I've been to 3 congressional hearings on this stuff over the last 20 years. This could be fixed, but nobody seems to have the fortitude and the will to do it.
Joe Drape, who covers horse racing for the New York Times. Joe, thank you.
Robin, thanks for having me.
Actress Chloe Sevigny has finally gotten me to a zombie movie. Chloe, Bill Murray, and Adam Driver play small-town cops watching as zombies lumber over to their police station.
Shouldn't we be telling each other that it's all going to be okay? That this will all go away like a bad dream? Ronnie?
Gee, Lindy, I'm not sure I can say that.
Cliff? Please?
It's all going to be okay, Mindy. Maybe it'll all just go away like a bad dream.
The Dead Don't Die is director Jim Jarmusch's dark comedy, Zomcom. In it, the Earth gets knocked off its axis by polar fracking. The dead rise up, grim hilarity ensues. And for the actress who's been called the it girl and the coolest girl in the world, a fashionista and a film director herself, it does not end well. And Chloe Sevigny joins us in the studio. Hi.
Hi. Is that a spoiler that it doesn't end well? It doesn't end well for all of us.
It's a zombie movie.
Who does it end well for? The alien.
The alien. Okay. There's an alien. Look,
there's a spoiler.
I did go to this movie because of you. But what did you think when Jim Jarmusch wrote you a letter and said, I have this idea?
I was surprised, actually. He said, I want to make this ridiculous zombie picture. And I was like, why zombies? Like, I had never had an affinity for zombies. I love vampire pictures.
Yes, you said that.
It's one of my favorites. And I was kind of sad that I wasn't asked to be in Only Lovers Left Alive. But that's okay. I'll forgive him.
But tell me, actually, you're sort of just take a little side detour here. You are a vampire aficionado, it sounds like. But you knew all the best films. What are they?
Near Dark, Lost Boys, even Coppola's. I think in high school and I read Dracula, I just became seduced. Okay. And then I just, yeah.
But not a zombie person.
Not a zombie picture person, no.
Okay. But it is kind of ridiculous. It's a wonderful, ridiculous movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's as if Bill Murray is playing Andy Griffith. You're in Mayberry and suddenly the Earth gets off its axis. Now, there's a ridiculousness, but there's a seriousness. I know Jim Jarmusch does not like you to talk about what the meaning of this is.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the meaning of this?
Well, I think that the environmental issues that we are facing today weigh very heavily upon Jim's soul. And I think that this is like a commentary on that, a little bit of a wake-up call to viewers, just to think about their own consumerism. And, you know, Jim wants us to think more about, like, empathy, what we can do to help others. I mean, to me, I always think, like, we're living in the zombie apocalypse now with people in their phones, and people just are, like, not connecting on, like, a real level to one another, and it's terrifying.
We're already zombies.
Yeah.
That's very funny, too, because this is what happens in the film. The zombies find smartphones and they're walking around.
Well, they gravitate towards their addictions. So some, yes, Chardonnay, coffee, Wi-Fi, fashion, candy, power tools, kind of runs the gamut.
What would it be for you?
Maybe vintage. I will
yes.
say I do have a little bit of an addiction. It's a way for me to get out of my head. And I always promote buying secondhand. And I think that we all have to, reassess what we're purchasing and why we're making purchases and what we're trying to fulfill within ourselves.
We'll talk about that, because it was Jay McInerney, himself the IT writer at the time, who saw you on the streets in New York. I think you were still a teen, maybe early 20s, coming in from Connecticut to New York. And something about the way you dressed and presented yourself, he pronounced you the it girl, wrote that 7-page New Yorker spread, and everybody was suddenly, who is this? You were the fashion, you are, for many, the fashion template, the person they look to. What's that part of your life like?
I have a complicated relationship with that part. You know, I do love style, and I have a lot of friends that work in the industry. I also hate it.
Yeah.
Hate the responsibility.
Like, you can't just show up in something, like, really, like...
I mean, I guess I could. You know, I feel like sometimes I'm pushing it too hard, and maybe I should just, yeah, just find some sort of uniform and just, like, go to film festivals and that.
Well, it made me think of something you've said about Jarmusch when you worked with him in Broken Flowers. He styles me the same way as Broken Flowers. That's the way he likes to look at me. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting, because you become, as an actress, what somebody else wants to see.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you become, as an it girl, what somebody else wants to see. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if that's why now a more mature Chloe Sevigny is a director.
I think so. I think also, like, people see me suspended in time as this, like, young person. I think a lot of child actors, and I started fairly young. I wasn't a child, but I was 19, and I had this opportunity, and I ran with it. And then you're like, well, what if I want to do something else? I'm already this one thing. And people always give actors a hard time when they try and, you know, segue into different fields. So, you know, the fashion thing is natural for me, and now filmmaking. So I think that's why so many of us tend to stay within our realm.
You talk about starting really young. I'm thinking kids. Steve Buscemi, who, oh boy, it doesn't end well for him in this movie either. He's in this movie, but you also were in his Trees Lounge. That's when you first felt like a real actress. It set the tone for your career.
Mm-hmm.
What is that tone? How would you define it?
I think just working with, you know, real people, making really grounded stories. I mean, I don't know how grounded The Dead Don't Die is, but
well, they
my
come
characters.
Out of the ground.
Yeah. Oh, maybe that's the wrong word. But, and also working on in ensemble casts. I think all, you know, most of my career in television and films, I've worked in on ensemble casts. I've never desired being like the star of a movie or carrying a movie or having a vehicle, you know. Mm-hmm. I did try and do that once with this Lizzie Borden movie that came out a couple years ago, and I had to produce that myself in order to have a lead role. But for the most part, yeah, I've been most comfortable in an ensemble environment.
Wait, why do you think that is? Are you saying Hollywood wouldn't see you as a lead?
I mean, I haven't been offered any leads necessarily. Maybe in some, like, you know, indie schmindies, but...
Who do we talk to? How do we write this wrong? Let's talk about a couple of the roles. You play Lana, the girlfriend of the trans young man played by Hilary Swank in Boys Don't Cry.
Mm-hmm.
These were real people.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make you have more, I don't know, was there more of a tenderness for you to bring to that character?
Very much so. Thinking about all those people involved in those horrific crimes and, you know, even beyond Brandon.
The trans man was murdered.
Yes, yeah.
When it was discovered.
A couple of his friends. And, you know, just thinking about Lana and her life, and she's still in Nebraska, and there I was, like, at the Oscars, draped in a gown and jewels, and just, like... how complicated all of that is. And even coming from kids, like my first film, I think a lot about like opportunity versus exploitation and what that is, you know. That's, I'm segueing now. But
that's all right. That's okay. So you're conscious of, you know, privilege as an actor.
Yeah.
But I have to ask you about Big Love.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you talked about how Jarmusch saw you and how he sees you, and that's the role that you played in the film Dead Don't Die, we should explain it's kind of a mannish police uniform, and you have your hair severely pulled back.
Yeah.
Well, that severity made me think of Big Love. You play one of three wives in a polygamous, fundamentalist Mormon family.
Mm-hmm.
And your character, Nikki, who was so morally righteous.
I mean, I would never do anything to hurt them. I would move off the street before I would do that.
You scared me, you know, sort of like, I thought if you ever bump into Chloe Sevigny, she's going to straighten you right out.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that being the moral center. You often have that.
Yeah, the moral compass.
Yeah.
Yes. But I always thought of Nikki on Big Love as the most kind of sympathetic of the women, you know, because she's cradling these two worlds, you know, coming from the compound and how she was raised and the abuse that she was had to deal with there, and then like trying to find her way. And I always felt very sorry for her.
I mean, yes, I did. But also, you wanted to be morally upright when you were around her. By the way, we here think that you single-handedly launched the prairie fashion look with that character. Yes? Maybe?
I don't know.
Maybe?
I don't want to take credit for anything.
Well, back to the film we're supposed to be talking about. Your character, although kind of severe, has a soft side. And there's a scene, I don't want to give too much away, but we've already said zombies are everywhere, and you're trapped in this police car with Bill Murray, Adam Driver, and the zombies are slithering everywhere. Were you ever afraid?
I wasn't afraid, but I was playing the trauma. I was like, I was trying to, just like be in the moment. And knowing that I was between, Bill and Adam who were doing this, their dry shtick, and I was having to be like the in for the audience. And like, can you imagine like the denial one would be feeling in that, or wanting one to comfort you and like who you're turning to for that. And, and just being terrified. I was just trying to play it as real as I could and hoping that, that people would feel something through the performance.
You. Thank you. Because we were. And just Bill Murray, is it true that you were sitting in the cop car waiting for a scene and he just took off?
He took us on a joyride. It's true. Yeah, he did. And we were in uniform and I was like, is this illegal maybe? Turn on the lights. None of us had phones. None of us had money. The gas tank was like on empty. I was like, where are we going? He had taken one of those little maps that are like out of scale, from the diner, like with local attractions. He's like, I remember this farm stand. He's like, I think I can find my way back. And I was like, are you sure? Like, what if we get lost? We're upstate. Like every road turns onto another road. All looks the same. And
but he, Chloe,
he navigated, and we went in, got some produce. It was real fun.
and you played the part of the moral compass.
I did.
In the cuff card.
I was like, is this right? These producers are going to be freaking out.
Listen, we wish you the best with everything that's next. It's really been a ride.
Oh,
get that
you.
Segue there. with you, Chloe Sevigny, now appearing in director Jim Jarmusch's new ZomCom. Zombie comedy, although I'm telling you, if you haven't seen a zombie film before...
I think you should go back and watch Night of the Living Dead. I'll give you an appreciation of this one.
Right. It's the dead don't die, though. And Chloe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave. Control your comfort.
Defense contractor Raytheon and aerospace company United Technologies have announced a merger, which they're calling Raytheon Technologies, and others are calling one of the biggest corporate mergers of the year, manufacturing everything from Tomahawk missiles to commercial airplane seats. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Also our partner here at Here and Now. So Raytheon, the largest producer of missiles in the world in addition to missile defense systems like the Patriot. United Technologies does what? Have a harder time reaching that.
Yeah, and you know what? United Technology does actually changed at the end of last year. The company announced in November that it was actually morphing into three separately traded public companies. So the core business, this aerospace business, that's the one that makes jet engines and landing gear and other commercial and military plane equipment, that is remaining under this United Technologies umbrella. That's the one that actually is being merged. It also encompasses Collins Aerospace and Pratt & Whitney brands, which they bought in the last year or so. Then they're spinning off two other actually pretty well-known brands, Otis Elevator, that's a different division, and Carrier. That will happen next year.
Okay. Well, you mentioned public. Shareholders have to approve the merger. But these companies have been very successful on their own. The stock price of each went up more than 20% this year. That outpaced the market. So why the merger?
You know, there's been a consolidation of the aerospace industry. I actually didn't know this since this story broke, but over the past 30 years or so, the American defense industry has gotten a lot smaller. So there were something like 60 different companies, now just a handful, a few major ones. Now, these survivors, they're hoping to gain scale by getting better terms from their suppliers or cutting costs, and then they can invest more in new technologies.
Yeah, well, this new proposed company, again, has to be approved, Raytheon Technologies, will be the second largest aerospace company in the world. They're just going to be behind Boeing. Boeing's not had a good year. How is this going to affect Boeing?
I think that Boeing basically has its hands full right now dealing with the fallout from the 737 MAX crashes. You know, just yesterday, American Airlines said it's going to extend flight cancellations through the beginning of September for the MAX. I think this suggests that Boeing is really going to be focused right now on getting that plane back into operation and complying with safety issues. And they're probably not going to be really caring about this merger for the time being.
Yeah. Look, defense spending is high right now, expected to go back down with sequestration, automatic spending cuts on the horizon, Democrats in control of the House. But how will this merger hit the Pentagon? What happens there?
You know, the Pentagon is obviously pretty interested in the deal. Raytheon is one of its biggest customers. And in addition to missile defense and precision weapons that it purchases from Raytheon, it actually has a pretty long relationship with Pratt & Whitney. And I think that the Pentagon is really trying to squeeze all parts of this industry to look for better deals. And as you said, you know, the Pentagon is actually looking at spending less. And I think that combined with weaker projected growth in commercial aviation means this sector is preparing for leaner times. I really think that's the core of this merger and all the consolidation, that the good times can be sporadic. We got to prepare for what could come next.
Yeah, the leaner times. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In recent polling on abortion, three-quarters of Americans want to keep Roe v. Wade in place. Some want restrictions, but according to polling from NPR, PBS, NewsHour, and Marist, they want it to stand. And this comes as states continue to pass legislation aimed at dismantling Roe. The latest is Louisiana, where the law bans abortion after around 6 weeks. And unlike other states, Louisiana's law has support from Democrats. Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards signed it. Democratic State Rep. Katrina Jackson is one of many backing it. She joins us. Representative Jackson, welcome.
Thank you for having me. How are you today?
We're just fine. And we would note that the bill doesn't go into effect yet. Its aim is the same as others we're seeing in other states, to be challenged and get to the Supreme Court and overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, it's understandable that someone may be personally against abortion, but why do you want to outlaw it for other women?
I don't see it as outlawing it for other women. I see it as fighting for the life of the child. And I tell women all the time, fighting for the life of the child is like fighting for them because someone chose to have them. If you were born after 1973, someone chose you and gave you a fighting chance. So we don't see it as restrictive, having a restrictive measure in law. We see it as fighting for life altogether. Yeah. In Louisiana, Democrats consider themselves whole life Democrats, which means we fight for life from the womb to the tomb. Yeah. So we fight for everyone's life.
What about the fact that the bill, as many others, doesn't have an exception for rape or incest? So a young girl raped by a relative, perhaps, becomes pregnant, would have to continue that pregnancy.
Well, it's a heartbeat bill. So the bill doesn't ban abortion altogether. It just deals with until you can hear a heartbeat. And so to the extent that a young lady finds out that she's pregnant prior to the recognition of a heartbeat, then abortion will still be, if this bill is in place, legal in our state. This bill in Louisiana had no chance of passing with any exceptions in it. Actually, we had an amendment that was voted on the floor, but it was voted down.
Well, most women don't know they're pregnant before 6 weeks, and so they wouldn't have that chance that you're talking about, that window between 1 and 6 weeks. So there's questions about that. Why not have the exceptions? But you also feel that there might be a racial component to this. Tell us about that.
Right. I have my own bill in the state of Louisiana, and that's House Bill 425, which is a constitutional amendment that's going to let the voters decide whether or not our own state constitution recognizes a right to abortion. The reason being is because since 1973, since the inception of Roe versus Wade's opinion, 19 million black babies have been killed in the womb from abortion. That's more blacks being killed from abortion than any other sickness, illness, or a violent crime or nonviolent crime combined. Here in Louisiana, we make up about 30% of the population as African-Americans, but we make up 60-some percent of the voter population. In the United States, we make up about 13 to 14% of the population, but the abortion population for African-Americans is 30-some percent. African-American babies are being aborted at alarming numbers. I do not believe that abortion is an answer to poverty. One of the most egregious arguments that I hear daily is that a woman should have a choice based on whether or not she can take care of the child. I don't ever believe abortion should be the answer to poverty. I believe that as African-Americans, we should be fighting to make sure that we implement policies that give families livable wages, that make sure women have equal pay. And so to me, abortion is not the answer. And for some reason, it's being taunted as the answer for African-Americans who live in poverty situations.
I just want to underscore what you just said. You call abortion, when it comes to African-Americans and the numbers you just cited, genocide.
Right. Yeah. Abortion takes more black lives than anything else combined each year.
Look, as you well know, the numbers of abortions in the United States have gone way down because of access to birth control. The numbers among African-American women have also gone down. We're reading the rate of abortion is currently at its lowest point since Roe v. Wade. But still, African-American women of color still have higher rates of abortion than white women do. We're reading an article in The Atlantic, 2014, but I think the stats are still the same, you know, which wonders why that is. It says that it could be, in many cases, because of access to things like birth control. So question to you there, should the effort be more in trying to prevent pregnancies than into stopping women ending them if they feel that desperate? So that's question number one. Let me just put that out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a dual effort. And that's why I say we call ourselves whole life Democrats. In the state of Louisiana, Governor Edwards, who's a whole life Democrat, myself and others fought for Medicaid expansion for 3 years when he was in the legislature. And finally, when he was governor, in the first day, he signed Medicaid expansion into law by executive order with all of our support. We've done a number of things regarding criminal justice reform to unite mothers and fathers with their children. We have a joint effort on sex education. So there are basically sometimes when you hear someone say they're pro-life, they're just saying choose life in the womb. For us, it's totally different. We don't look at our pro-life stance just by abortion bills. We look at the other measures as pro-life as well.
Well, again, and this is in 2014, the statistics were that an African-American woman was five times likelier to have an abortion than a white woman, a Latina woman, more than twice as likely. This is according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So there is this disparity you're speaking of. But what do you say to the young women, including one who's profiled in this article? I'll call her by her first name, Renee. She was about to have an abortion, and her reasoning was just what you're talking about. She didn't want to be that statistic. She didn't want to be the stereotype of an African-American woman having a child out of wedlock. She said the image is that we are promiscuous, we just have babies. I don't want to be that.
And I understand that. There is a stereotype. And that's why I believe legislators across this country who are putting so much effort into protecting abortions should be putting effort into making sure people have access to health care, that sex education in an appropriate level is taught in schools. That's the way to attack this.
Are you concerned that in banning abortions, especially since they are down across the board, are you worried that women will go back to the days of, you know, back alley horrendous abortions if it's driven underground?
Honestly, I think it's going to make women more responsible. Sometimes I find that when there are options out there, and look, even when we were children, we dealt with this. But depending on how strict your parent was or how much you thought you could get away with, you got away with it. One thing that's out on the market that was not on the market during those times of back alley abortions was the morning after pill, right? So let's say you get up and you know you made a mistake and you weren't on birth control and you didn't use contraceptive or condom. The morning after pill is purchased over the counter.
Yeah. Well, and there's the morning after pill. There's also a series of pills that would induce an abortion, and technically, in the first couple
abortion
of weeks.
Pill,
right,
yes.
Right.
An abortion pill is something I don't agree with. The morning after pill stops you from ovulating and stops you from actually an egg being fertilized. So what I'm saying is today there are so many other forms of contraception all the way down to after you make a decision that will result in an unwanted pregnancy.
So to clarify, you don't believe in the abortion pills after ovulation, but you do believe in preventing the ovulation. But as you know, there are some pushing to grant personhood to even the embryo, to the zygote, who have spoken aloud about, and I'd even like to see birth control done away with, because that's preventing the rights of an egg to try to ovulate. I mean, you hear what I'm saying.
And that's where I differ.
But you worry about a slippery slope that you may be getting on.
No.
Yeah.
Because I control my advocacy. And just because someone else is advocating for it doesn't mean I have to advocate for it.
We are hearing, obviously, that many of your constituents agree. But also, we're reading a quote from a voter printed in one of Louisiana's papers, The Advocate. It's addressed to your governor there, the Democratic governor. It says, the Republicans won't support you because you're a Democrat. We Democrats can't trust you. You're done. Do you worry about the political position this puts you in? It sounds like, I'm guessing, maybe not.
Oh, the governor and myself, when we ran, both of us were very clear that we were pro-life, whole-life Democrats. We never hid it. But I was also very clear on this, that I was a Christian and that I was going to allow my Christian values to guide me, because I wanted them to know that. So if they didn't want to elect me, they wouldn't elect me.
That's Louisiana State Rep. Katrina Jackson, a Democrat, very much in support of that state's new abortion law that would ban abortions after around 6 weeks and have no exception for rape or incest. Representative Jackson, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Heavy rain and major flooding continue to wreak havoc in the plains, Midwest, and the Southeast. Parts of North Carolina got at least 6 inches of rain yesterday. Officials there say 3 people died Saturday night after their car became submerged under 6 feet of water. In St. Louis, the Mississippi River had its second highest crest Saturday night at 46 feet, according to the National Weather Service. Further south in Louisiana, officials have opened up the Bonnie Carey Spillway to release some water from the Mississippi River, allowing trillions of gallons of fresh water and runoff to flow into the Mississippi Sound. This is all having adverse effects on the marine life there. 125 dolphins and more than 140 sea turtles have died so far this year. Here in house, Peter O'Dowd, who's been reporting on the flooding in Mississippi, spoke with Dr. Moby Salangi, president and executive director of the Institute for Marine Mammal Studies in Gulfport, Mississippi.
And you've described this flood as a freshwater hurricane in the Mississippi Sound. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's kind of unprecedented. We have a very large amount of river water that has been diverted into Mississippi that has caused a considerable change in the habitat.
And how bad is the damage to the sea life and to the habitat?
Well, I mean, considering that we're not connected to the Mississippi River, we are getting trillions of gallons of river water, which is not just fresh water. It has all sorts of mud, clay, silt, all sorts of industrial, agricultural, and sewage waste from 31 states and 2 provinces in Canada. What it does is reduces the salinity of the water. It brings in lots of other pollutants into it that cause a significant change in the ecosystem.
And it's killed dolphins. It's killed sea turtles. What happens when these animals come in contact with that fresh water?
Well, I mean, these are top predators. We use dolphins as good biological indicators of the environment. They're just like a black box of an airplane. When they start being affected, you know that something in the entire ecosystem has changed. And what we are seeing is that the blue crab fishery, this is the food that the turtles eat, has declined almost 35-40% or more. There's been a total loss of the oyster fishery. The oysters are the habitat for the blue crabs. And so there's a chain reaction. The salinity, which is normally between 10 and 15 parts per thousand, is now running at 0 to 5 parts per thousand, mostly towards zero. And so when you have saltwater animals that are now exposed to literally fresh water, for example, in dolphins, we're seeing very serious skin lesions. You know, the sores then open up and the bacteria and the fungi and the viruses enter into the animal and make it sick. Now, the jury is out on the turtles, but them being reptiles, they have scales on their body and you don't see visible effects. But because their diet may be changing, we may be seeing some physiological changes. We are going to be doing necropsies and pathologies and toxicologies to connect the dots.
Do you think that this problem will clear itself up once the floods finally recede, or do you think there's been long-term damage done?
Well, all of this was designed in the 1920s.
So, and you're referring to the flood control infrastructure, the Bonnie Carey spillway.
That's correct, and it's operational paradigm. But my question to you is how many people are driving 1920 cars?
Mm.
And so what we are seeing now is that the Bonnie Carey would be opened up every 5 or 10 years. Now, in the last 4 years, it has opened 3 times. And then this year, unprecedented in its 100-year history, it has opened twice. And it's going to continue for a long period of time. Usually, it ends up in 2 or 3 weeks, and then things start getting back to normal. We do have an estuarine environment which can handle fluctuations, but not this persistent exposure.
But what should be done about it? When you open that spillway, it protects a lot of human life downstream and a lot of property. So it's not so simple just to say, don't open the spillway.
Well, you're absolutely right. But the problem we see is that Mississippi has never had a seat on the table. They never thought that the spillways or diversions would cause any issues to Mississippi. Our problem is, for example, they put all this water into Lake Pontchartrain, which is a huge body of water, bigger than the Mississippi Sound. And that is in Louisiana. So they felt that, oh, okay, we'll just put it in our waters. But then it opens up into the Mississippi Sound through a very narrow passageway. And even if they close the Bonnie Carey today, it'll be weeks and months before you see that exchange. Secondly, being at the dead end of the Gulf, there's no exchange of water as you see in the deeper waters. And so the water stagnates, it slowly is released, and this is a very long-term exposure. Now, what do we do next? Of course, there are other spillways, the Morganza Spillway. That should be open first if you want to look at strategy, but they want to protect the resources of Louisiana more so than Mississippi.
Hmm. That's Dr. Moby Salonghi, Executive Director of the Institute for Marine Mammal Studies in Gulfport, Mississippi, sounding the alarm about marine life in the Mississippi Sound dying from the impacts of the river flooding upstream. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And we'll link you to Peter's terrific reporting on the flooding in Mississippi at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.